welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight, we're going to talk about The Godfather Part 2, which is coincidentally Part 2 of our Godfather trilogy.
Also, the second best movie ever made.
And the first would be?
Yeah, what would you consider the first?
Heat.
Oh, of course.
Well, we got to talk about Apocalypse Now. We got to talk about Chinatown, which, by the way, Chinatown lost Best Picture to this movie. And I think
it's fair.
I think Chinatown's a better movie than this one is. But we'll have to talk about that. So, Drew, you're still our cruise director. So, lead us in to this cruise of Godfather Part 2.
Sure. This was, I mentioned last time that I caught up on The Godfather early on in college because it was sort of a hole in my pop culture education. One of those things that I knew I needed to get to, so I got to it. And I loved it, and I went right into Godfather Part 2, and I was blown away by how it simultaneously continued the story of the Corleone family while also filling in the backstory of the original Godfather. And I had never seen a movie quite like this before.
I think it was certainly revolutionary for that aspect. Some people didn't like it. I think the New York Times reviewer did not give it good grades. But pretty much everybody else did. So, Brother Jay, this is your first viewing of The Godfather 2.
Yeah.
And what did you think? First impression.
First, I'm going to make a prediction that The Godfather 3 is going to open with a party. Just like 1 and 2. There's going to be an assassination attempt, just like 1 or 2. There's going to be a huge family conflict, just like 1 and 2, and somebody tragically will die and or be killed by Michael.
Okay, that's a bold prediction.
So this movie was formulaic.
So you think it was derivative of 1?
Yes.
Do you think it was...
It had very similar... metering tempo. I mean, it was nice to have the addition of the flashbacks and the extra story, but without that, it was just basically the first movie just kind of replaying a different generation.
But in a way that continues to tell the story, or in a way that you found just aggravating?
It was predictable. It didn't surprise me.
Did you enjoy it?
No.
Are you looking forward to Part 3?
No. No, I will say, it's visually, it's a gorgeous movie, and it was well acted, and so, again, I think it's worth watching, so I'm glad I watched it. I probably won't watch it again.
I guess I didn't like the flashbacks as much as I thought I would, although I'm going to talk about some things that I really liked about it, but... I thought they could have actually just done the Michael story moving forward. Although it turns out the novel that it was based on only deals with the backstory. It doesn't deal anything with the future. That was all Coppola and Puzo writing the screenplay.
So the story advancing in Tahoe and all that was not in the book?
Brand new stuff.
Oh, see, I would have much preferred it that way without the Tahoe stuff.
Oh, really?
Because I thought that detracted. I really liked the history and finding out the origin story and seeing, you know, the trauma and the pain and the strife that led to the upheaval and why it made Don Vito, you know, why it made him have his drive for his family. I liked that richness of that backstory.
You didn't think the parallel with how Michael's story going forward both mirrors, it follows along with his father, but also he veers off in several different crucial moments?
I think Michael is trying to be a poor imitation.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that's part of the point.
I think he's trying to fill shoes that he's unprepared to fill, and I give him credit for trying, and I give him credit for trying to be his dad, but I think that he didn't start from the ground up long early enough that he's kind of, his instincts are good, but you know, his skills aren't exactly the greatest, and so he makes these missteps, and he's guided by a strong sense of family, except that he doesn't always handle his family very well. So while he has great love for his family, sometimes he treats them very poorly.
Yeah, I think that's really the interesting part of this movie, is that there are so many parallels to the first one. And even within it, there are parallels between the flashback and the current story. But the difference is, in trying to be like his father and complete his father's mission, it has the opposite effect on his family. His family is disintegrating out from under him because of what he's doing. Whereas Vito, everything he did was to set up his family for the future and really hold them close together. And it worked. In the first movie, they were sort of torn apart by external forces. But in this movie, it is really internal forces. And I think that's the difference.
I think also the fact that, you know, Don Vito clearly loved his wife, and his wife clearly loved him. And Kay doesn't really love Michael.
Does anybody love Michael?
His kids do.
I'm not so sure.
Well, we'll find out in part three.
But I think the generation that shift, the shift from Michael's generation, from his dad's generation, that the family dynamic does degrade. And I think that is part of why the family stability becomes so untenable. It's because he just doesn't have the family stability, which without that stability, it's hard for him to keep his mind in the business because he's distracted on too many fronts.
I noticed that he also did not have the luck that Vito had.
Well, and some people say that's skill. Was that luck or was that skill? Well, also, Don Vito got shot.
Well, so. No, I mean, yeah, but Michael had some bad luck in this movie toward the end.
Time is luck.
Ah, yes. Very nice. So, shall we... any history before we get into the plot?
What history? Kind of history?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Any tidbits you want to... I mean, did you realize that James Caan asked for and got the same amount of money for his cameo at the end that he got for the entire Godfather 1?
Oh, jeez.
Nice work.
Yeah, did you know that Marlon Brando was supposed to be at the end flashback scene with all the boys, but he didn't show up because on the day of filming because he was in a fight with Paramount? Like, Paramount treated him poorly on The Godfather. So he said, fuck him, and didn't show up. So they just shot around him.
No, that's too bad.
It was effective, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was very effective, I think. The one thing about the movie is that I liked the end of the movie quite a bit. It just, I think the pacing was not what I remembered it being. And I realized it was going to be a long movie. It's a double disker.
Oh, my God. It was... Not for me.
It was like 3.5 hours long or more.
Oh, so long.
Yeah, I was struggling this week a bit, so I wasn't wasn't quite sure how I was going to fit the movie in. But once I got into it, it was really like, it was really comforting. It was like eating comfort food, experiencing this movie again. Once I got past the first half hour or so, it was a very pleasant ride. I think I made it almost all the way through in one go.
Why? What was wrong with that first half an hour?
I tried to start the movie a few days early because I knew it was going to be so long, and you know I watch movies in chunks anyway. And I kept falling asleep, like, you know, after like 7 minutes. So I watched probably the first half hour, probably three times.
I got to say, I was really, really distracted by Robert De Niro. It took me a long time to get past that.
Just because of what he's become?
I didn't realize it was him. It took me a half an hour of him before I realized it was him, because it was bugging me. I was trying to figure out who he was. Like, who is that? And I didn't want to look it up.
I had a similar experience the first time I watched it, as he was so young that it was distracting.
Young and skinny and...
Well, and he looks like so many other actors nowadays. I mean, I was like, who is... And I had that problem that I had with the last movie, where I was like, he looks like somebody modern. And I was trying to place it, and then I had to divorce myself from that. And obviously, I said to myself, well, duh, it's Robert De Niro. So I got over it, but it was kind of really distracting. I mean, in a good way. I'm not saying it was bad. So.
Well, and the fact that he speaks mostly Sicilian.
Yeah.
And one of the great treasures of this movie is because the actor that played Clemenza didn't want to come back. They made up this new character, Frankie Pentangeli, and he is my favorite in the whole movie.
Oh, he is great. Although I like young Clemenza myself. I think he's my favorite.
Young Clemenza is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I really like middle Clemenza, when it's just young Clemenza with a giant like pregnancy belly.
Well, I love the fact that after the first time you meet young Clemenza, he eats in every scene. There is not a scene that he's not eating, which is hilarious. So, the film begins in 1901 in Corleone, Sicily, at the funeral of young Vito's father, Antonio Endolini, who's been murdered for an insult to the local mafia lord, Don Ciccio. By the way, I had a little trouble finding out who played Don Ciccio, who, by the way, the actor's name is Giuseppe Cilato, or Ciato. I think it's Cilato in Spanish. But unfortunately, or in Italian, but unfortunately, he was originally called Don Fernando in the script, and so in the credits, it has him as Don Fernando. Or maybe it's Don Francisco, but one of the two. So...
It's one of those last-minute changes they didn't quite note.
Yeah. But Don Ciccio has killed his father. And so Vito's older brother is swore revenge on the Don and is missing from the funeral procession. And we have young Vito and his mother. And during the procession, we hear gunfire, and we find out that Vito's older brother has been murdered. And... Vito's mom goes to the Don in what I think was a pretty great scene, explaining that...
With Vito.
Yeah, with Vito. Because Vito is 9 years old, by the way, and he is slow. He's a dummy. He's harmless, and he's slow, and he is not worth killing.
Almost mute.
Yes. But, unfortunately... So yeah, Don Ciccio realizes he has to kill all of the male family members because they're going to have revenge at some point in his life. So, Mom, who's a gutsy broad, tells Vito to run and intends to stab the Don. That does not happen. They kill her in a very... they did this in The Godfather Part 1, too, that I found just a little bit distracting, but they had the thing where the person who gets shot by a gun flies backward really fast, like there's a cable attached to them. And I found that just a tiny bit distracting, but...
No, I didn't notice that at all.
Yeah, if you watch the scene where she gets shot, she flies backward. It's pretty fun. So then we see Vito getting on a ship and coming to New York, landing at Ellis Island.
And a very iconic, viewing of the Statue of Liberty.
Yep. Oh, and he goes through the whole immigrant experience where they change his name. And they put an X on him, which at the time meant that they thought he had mental disabilities.
Well, they changed his name inadvertently because the guy at customs or immigration didn't really listen.
Yes, which I imagine happened quite a bit.
Well, a lot of people, when they come over, Americanize their name anyway. Or used to, I should say.
So now we see that young Vito Corleone goes to America.
But he has that nice moment where he's quarantined.
Yeah, for 3 months.
But he starts singing opera.
Yes.
And that's the first time he actually speaks, right?
Yeah, in the whole movie. Yep. So then we flash to 1958. And we have a very similar scene to the first movie where we open with a wedding. This time we open with a first communion, christening, whatever it's called. I think it's first communion of Michael's son. And so we have sort of a similar thing going on. And one of the people that meets with Michael during this party is Nevada Senator Pat Geary, played by G.D. Spradlin in a great smarmy way. And apparently this character was sort of loosely based on the Kennedys. Like when Jack Kennedy was a senator. I believe one of the rough drafts or whatever for Godfather 3 dealt with the assassination. And the mafia ties to that. So.
Since the mafia was actually accused of it.
Yeah, some people believe.
I have a book, actually.
Yeah, I think I have several myself.
I've read a book as a teenager.
Yep. There's that Marilyn Monroe and Sam Giancana connection with Jack Kennedy.
I think I read the mob killing of JFK and the Chappaquiddick book at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
That was summer reading, like my junior high year, I think.
Yeah, I know I read Best Evidence. When I was a senior in high school, and it was like a 1,200-page book. And fascinating, if probably wrong. But there were a lot of footnotes, so. Anyhow. So I don't know about you guys, but I thought the senator was pretty great.
Well, let's cut out the bullshit. I don't want to spend any more time here than I have to. You can have the license. Price is $250,000, plus a monthly payment of 5% of the gross. Of all four hotels, Mr. Corleone.
Now, the price for the license is less than $20,000, am I right?
That's right.
Now, why would I ever consider paying more than that?
Because I intend to squeeze you. I don't like your kind of people. I don't like to see you come out to this clean country in your oily hair, dressed up in those silk suits, and try to pass yourselves off as decent Americans. I'll do business with you, but the fact is that I despise your masquerade, the dishonest way you pose yourself and your whole fucking family.
Senator. We're both part of the same hypocrisy. But never think it applies to my family.
All right. Some people have to play little games. You play yours. So let's just say that you'll pay me because it's in your interest to pay me. But I want your answer in the money by noon tomorrow. And one more thing. Don't you contact me again, ever. From now on, you deal with Turnbull. Open that door, son.
Senator, you can have my answer now if you like. My offer is this. Nothing. Not even the fee for the gaming license, which I would appreciate if you would put up personally.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Yeah, he was shameless in his mispronunciation.
Oh, and also, he pulled no punches, called them names, and gave them orders. But Michael was typical Michael Corleone, and basically says that not only is he not going to pay the money that the senator is asking for, but the senator is going to end up paying for the licensing fee on the casino that he wants, or the hotel, or gaming license, or whatever. And so that's where we see the exit of the senator. But then we have Connie, Talia Shire, shows up. And she is recently divorced from her second husband, but is planning to marry a guy named Merle Johnson. And who plays Merle Johnson?
No idea.
Merle Johnson is played by 50s icon Troy Donahue. As for you, Troy Donahue, I know what you want to do.
Nope.
Nope. Nope. You got us.
From Greece? No.
As for you, Troy Donahue, I know what you want to do. You got your crust, I'm no object of lust. I'm just plain Sandra Dee.
Well, Troy Donahue, silver screen, or not silver screen icon, more like teenage dream icon of the 50s, who's, by the way, his given name was Merle Johnson.
Nice.
But he is, of course, a deadbeat who has no obvious means of support, and Michael disapproves of right to his face. Tells Connie to come home and live with the family instead of hanging out with this trash.
After he tries to get Connie to talk to him privately.
Yes.
To give him credit for that.
Yeah, I did love that line. Tell him you're going to come home and spend time with your family. You don't want to see him anymore. He'll understand. He's like sitting right there.
Exactly. So we also meet the character of Johnny Ola, who's the right-hand man of Jewish gangster Hyman Roth, who is supporting Michael's move in the gaming industry. And who plays Hyman Roth?
Well, who plays Johnny Ola?
Johnny Ola is played by Dominic Chianese.
Uncle Junior.
Again out of town from The Sopranos?
Yeah, that's Uncle Junior.
I did not even know that. That's funny. Yeah. Well, Hyman Roth is played by Lee Strasberg of the Actor Studio.
Of the Method, right?
The Method, yeah. He's the basically the father of Method acting. And people like Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro and James Dean and a bunch of other people all came out of the Actor Studio. It's like he developed that. Dustin Hoffman, that whole thing. So, yeah, so he actually came out of retirement. Francis Ford Coppola wanted to actually hire Elia Kazan to be Hyman Roth.
But I could see that.
Yeah. And Elia Kazan is actually a student of Strasberg. But it didn't work out. Anyway. And I guess lore has it that Strasberg came out of retirement to play it only after a meeting for 45 minutes with Coppola and Coppola's father, Carmine Coppola. So, the father thing helped out. I don't know. So, in the meantime, we have a little bit of fun stuff with Frank Pentangeli. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, played by Michael.
He has, like the best mob nickname ever, Frankie Five Angels.
Do we know why that is?
Pentangeli.
Oh.
It literally translates to Five Angels.
Hello. Okay. okay, I did not catch that. dear. Anyway, so he took over from Clemenza. after Clemenza's death in New York. And he has problems with the Rosato brothers, who are backed by Roth. But because Michael is in this big business deal with Roth, he's not going to upset Roth's boys in the Rosato brothers. So he tells Pentangeli to just to let it be. Pentangeli doesn't like it. It's, again, reminiscent of the first movie, but you get to meet the characters. So Frankie Five Angels and goes about...
Fredo's there with his wife, who is a disaster.
Yes, that's true, yes. Fredo's wife is a disaster, and he cannot control her, which is a thing.
Yeah, this is really, really a sad scene when she's making a fool of herself on the dance floor because she's so drunk and making a big scene. And so Michael sends his boy Rocco over to Fredo to tell Fredo that if he can't control his wife, that Rocco is going to have to do it. And Fredo is just so pathetic. He's like, yeah, I think you're going to have to.
Yeah.
He's like, all right. And he just goes and drags his wife off the floor.
So later that night, he's getting ready for bed. And he notices that the, or actually his wife Kay, Diane Keaton, who's looking a little more like Diane Keaton in this movie, not a ton more, but she notices that the bedroom window drapes are open, which is unusual.
And this is actually like kind of a sweet family moment, because she seems genuinely happy to be with him, and his son left him a little drawing as a present. And
yes, yes. Also, do we know that she is pregnant at this time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So she is just pregnant, and just barely pregnant, not very pregnant. I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, so it is it is touching family time. It is not touching family. He's not touching his, anyway. Yes, it's a very sweet moment.
Well said.
Way to pivot.
And he realizes that the drapes are open, and is like, oh shit, and then, the bedroom is riddled with bullets, an assassination attempt on the Godfather.
It was a little out of character when he went, oh shit.
He's like, move your great ass. yeah. Anyway.
You got some great drapes.
So it's a big thing on their campus, cause they have like a compound. Is it an island?
It may actually, no, well, they're on the lake.
Okay, yeah. So it's like definitely a gated off compound.
Cause Lake, yes. Tahoe.
Oh, there you go. All right. Perhaps I'm not master of the obvious today. I've had a rough week. Okay.
So one side is actually bordered by water.
Yes.
I don't know if you caught on to that.
Copy that now.
Because they're on a lake.
Yes. Yes. So after, in the aftermath, they find out that there has to be a mole in the compound. So he tells Tom Hagen, Robert Duvall, that the hit was made with the help of somebody else, and he has to leave. And so he entrusts all his power to Hagen to protect his family.
Which surprises Tom, because Tom has been essentially cut out of all of the criminal enterprise.
Yes. yeah. And also... well, we'll talk about Tom a little bit later. But okay, so then we flash back to 1917 New York City, and we have Vito Corleone, the played by Robert De Niro. He's working at a grocery store at the Lower East Side with his friend Jinko Abbandando, who's played by Frank Severo.
And Jinko was supposed to be in the first movie, right? They filmed a scene where Jinko was dying of cancer?
You know, I don't know, but because I haven't seen the deleted scenes, because when they created that NBC miniseries where The Godfather, you know, in chronological order, they added some scenes that they had taken out of the movie to begin with. So there's these additional scenes you can watch. I believe it's on the fourth disc of my set.
I'll have to check the disc, yeah. I haven't looked yet.
But yeah, but I mean, his oil import business is the Jinko Pura oil or whatever. But he's working in a grocery store, and the neighborhood is controlled by a member of the Black Hand, in the character of Don Fanucci, who is also fantastic and a little cartoony. He's played by Gaston Motion.
Yeah, he's kind of like a cross between an evil mafioso and Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So, with a little Pepe Le Pew thrown in, I think. Nah, maybe not. Maybe he isn't as sexual as Pepe Le Pew, but... Yeah, so... He ends up losing his job at the grocery store because Don Fanucci's nephew or something needs a job. And the grocery store Jinko is like, he's very sad. He doesn't have a choice, but he's gotta fire Vito. And Vito's like, no, you're good to me. It's all right.
You're like a father to me.
Yeah. So we show Vito's character. And
Vito has a wife and a young son, Santino, at home.
Yes.
Who they show in this like really rickety looking crib.
Yes, yes. And they
possibly
live in...
the most terrifying part of this movie is when they put him in his crib with, like, lots of blankets. You're like, no, yeah, that's you true. Don't do that. No blankets in the crib.
Defying no all those... Yeah, probably put him face down, too. Face down, lots of blankets. But one night, he is a neighbor. Asks him... to hide a stash of guns for him. Basically passes him something through a window from across the alley. And it's a bunch of guns. And that neighbor is Clemenza, played by Bruno Kirby. And it turns out I really like Bruno Kirby. Generally.
Yeah, I do too. He's been in a lot of great things.
Yeah, so. But later, to repay the favor... he says that he has a friend that's got a fancy apartment and gave him a rug, and they just have to go pick it up. So they essentially go in and burgle a big mansion and steal a big rug, which is pretty hilarious. And the rug is, you know, it was just like the centerpiece of a room. Didn't look all that particularly huge in the context of the big room that they stole it from, but it turns out to be like wall-to-wall carpeting for their little apartment.
Yeah, it's as big as their apartment.
Which is pretty great. So Santino can play on the carpet.
Was that the same rug that was in his study in the first movie?
Good Quite question. Possibly. I don't know. Yeah, that would be kind of fun, but I did not know that. And yeah, I made a note that, yeah, after this scene, pretty much after the rug scene, Clemenza is always eating, which makes me smile. So, then the film flashes forward again. By the way, the test audiences on this movie hated the flashing back and forth. So, because I guess they did it a whole bunch more than they did in the final cut. So they had to re-edit at, like, the very, like, pretty much just before they dropped the film off at the theaters. I think it opened in 5 theaters, and it wasn't even the end was still kind of choppily edited when they first put it out. But yeah, anyway, so they flash back to Michael's time, and Michael is meeting with Hyman Roth in Miami, Florida. And here's where we find out that Michael is playing games. I mean, we already suspect that Michael is playing games, but Michael is constantly playing both sides against the middle. He's not like the measured, like, wise old owl that the elder Vito would have been. He's more of a schemer. He's the Templeton of the barnyard. A little bit. He's no Charlotte. That'll do, pig. You guys have no sense of history. Okay, so...
Wait, you just jumped from, like, Charlotte's Web to Babe.
I did, yes. Sense of history.
But in relation to The Godfather.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of parallels.
We're keeping up. We're just dumbfounded.
Okay, well, I couldn't figure out the mystery of the 5 angels. So, obviously, I'm not the smart guy in this little triad. So, triumvirate.
Trio.
I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Nothing.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So, back to Michael meeting with Hyman Roth in Miami, Florida. And Michael tells Roth that he believes that Frankie Five Angels, actually, I don't think they ever call him Frankie Five Angels, but Pentangeli is responsible for the assassination attempt, and he's going to pay for it. And then traveling to Brooklyn, Michael meets with Pentangeli and tells him that it was actually Roth who was behind it. And that Michael has a plan to deal with Roth, but in the meantime, he needs Frankie to cooperate with those Rosado brothers to put Roth off guard.
Every time they said Rosado brothers, I thought rice.
Yeah, like stirring forever until it gets smooth. Mm-hmm. But this is where we get the iconic line. Maybe the iconic line of, well, yeah, maybe, of how his father taught him many things in this room. Because Pentangeli is actually living in the Vito's old house. And so in the study, Michael tells him that his father taught him, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
It's good advice.
Yeah. So then while sleeping, Fredo, John Cazale, gets a phone call in the middle of the night from Johnny Ola, who is Roth's right-hand man. And then we find out that Fredo is the traitor. That, and Johnny Ola is telling him that Fredo wants to know about the meeting between Pentangeli and the Rosado brothers and whether or not Pentangeli is going to be alone. And Fredo is freaked the fuck out because the assassination attempt did not go well. And he know he's getting burnt here.
And he claims he didn't even know it was supposed to be a hit.
Yeah, so he's like, don't call me ever again. Johnny Ola.
Well, he's not the sharpest tool, so.
No, he's not. No.
He's a tool, but not the sharpest one.
Exactly. He has many gifts. Intelligence is not one of them. Also, loyalty seems to not to be one of them either. So. So then when Pentangeli goes to meet with the Rosados at a local bar, Danny Aiello, who I did not recognize, garrots him from behind or chokes him from behind saying, Michael Corleone says hello. And this would have been great, except that a policeman came in the bar right after this sort of thing happened. And so Frankie actually escapes death, is basically told who ordered the hit on him. So they end up leaving him for dead.
Which is weird, because that's not true.
But we don't know what's going on right now. We're all... It's all playing games. It's all House of Mirrors. It's all House of Cards. It's all House of Yes. It's all our house in the middle of the street. It's all Wilford Brimley with the diabetes.
It's very Templeton.
Anyway. Back in Nevada, Tom Hagen...
I missed the sock puppet.
Back in Nevada, Tom Hagen is called to a brothel in Carson City run by Fredo, where they find Senator Geary with a dead prostitute, which, quite honestly...
Well, let me interrupt you here, okay. Eric. So, Jason, you were watching this movie for the first time. Were you following this plot at all? Because it's pretty dense.
Was I following... Yeah, I was with it.
Okay, and did you think that Michael had actually ordered the hit on Pentangeli?
No.
I'd seen the movie before, and I thought he ordered the hit on Pentangeli.
My memory is the first time through this movie, I didn't know what was going on.
No, because Michael hasn't historically done the one-offs. He waits until there's a time, and then he takes care of business. He cleans house. He's not kind of a onesie-twosie kind of guy. He waits to get the most payoff, the most bang for his buck, if you will. So, no, I didn't suspect it was him. I suspected it was more to make him look bad, which is similar to the first movie.
Well, you were way smarter than I was when the first time I watched this movie.
No, I was just checking off the parallels, the cookie cutters.
So, by the way, did you think that Willie Chi-Chi was somehow related to Don Ciccio?
No.
Yeah, no, there's no. I didn't. I don't assume anybody's related.
Okay, because I was.
I thought he was hilarious, though.
Willie Chi-Chi?
Yeah. He's somebody who seemed to really like being a mafioso.
Oh yeah. Oh, he was having fun, you know, with in all the scenes. I mean, with the actor that played Pantangeli, it's hilarious. So, well, actually, there's a scene. I think it's the scene later on in the Senate chambers, like the last big scene. Before the Senators, where we see Pantangeli. Apparently, he did that really well in rehearsal. He, like, nailed it. And then he got drunk and came back for the real job. And couldn't quite get the same tone that Coppola saw in the... So that's kind of funny. Anyway.
You're talking about Willie Chi-Chi or Pantangeli?
No, Pantangeli. Yeah.
That's why he had to think really hard before he said every line?
I think so, yes.
Oh, God.
So, anyway, so we end up in Carson City with the dead prostitute and Senator Geary. By the way, no, of course, it's Senator Pat Geary and his wife, Pat. Yeah, you know, I think the original thought was that the Corleones were going to pay off the senator's gambling debts, but they decided to kind of go over the top with the dead prostitute. I thought it was a little convenient that there was a dead prostitute in Fredo's controlled brothel.
You don't think they killed her?
Oh, no, I think they probably killed her. But the fact that he was in Fredo's brothel is already a little suspect. But I don't know, maybe he was hanging out with those guys. He didn't seem to have any love for the greasy-haired wops, though.
Maybe Fredo owned all the brothels.
Maybe he did. It's possible. That seems right up Fredo's alley. So, in the meantime, Michael is meeting with Roth, this time in Havana, Cuba, in late 1958, when Batista is soliciting American investment. And in the background of all this politically are the guerrillas, the communist guerrillas who are trying to bring down the government. Because a little bit of history here, and I'm not educating you guys, and definitely after our Casablanca episode, I'm not going to rely on my own memory of history as much. But this was a big deal. They were going to do to Cuba kind of what they were doing to Nevada. They're trying to legitimize their business by taking over an entire country, pretty much, and having real leverage, international leverage. But unfortunately, the communist guerrillas kind of screwed that plan up.
Damn revolution.
I guess you don't see a lot of Che Guevara shirts on and Columbus Day parades. Okay, I don't know. So
I don't know either.
Anyway, so yeah.
I don't know where you're going with that.
Yeah, we're lost. Okay, I'm lost anyway.
So, we have a birthday party for Roth in Cuba because Roth has all the heads of all these businesses, like legitimate businesses, and then also the gambling industry represented by Michael Corleone.
Hospitality.
The hospitality, sorry.
And tourism.
And Michael is supposed to bring a suitcase full of money. That's kind of what he's bringing to this thing. But he never really services with it. Even when Fredo shows up with it, he never actually gives the thing to Roth. And Roth is kind of peeved about it. And Michael, who has seen... We've seen in Cuba a scene where one of the guerrillas killed some policemen and blew himself up at the same time with a grenade. So Michael saw that if you're willing to die for your cause, then you actually might win the revolution. So he's, of course, stringing Roth along too. And never actually turns over this promised money.
Yeah, and at one point he asked Roth who okayed the hit on Pantangeli.
Because he didn't. But then Roth kind of evades.
Yeah, he really deflects completely.
There was this kid I grew up with. He was younger than me. Sort of looked up to me, you know. We did our first work together. Worked our way out of the street. Things were good. We made the most of it. During Prohibition, we ran molasses into Canada. Made a fortune. Your father, too. As much as anyone, I loved him and trusted him. Later on, he had an idea to build a city out of a desert stopover for GIs on the way to the West Coast. That kid's name was Mo Green, and the city he invented was Las Vegas. This was a great man. Man of vision and guts. And there isn't even a plaque or a signpost or a statue of him in that town. Someone put a bullet through his eye. No one knows who gave the order. When I heard it, I wasn't angry. I knew Mo, I knew he was headstrong, talking loud, saying stupid things. So when he turned up dead, I let it go. And I said to myself, this is the business we've chosen. I didn't ask who gave the order, because it had nothing to do with business.
Yes.
Not even a plaque. Not even a damn statue.
Someone put a bullet in his eye. No one knows who gave the order, but it was somebody with a great ass. So, in the meantime, we have, of course, Senator Gary's over in Cuba, too. And Fredo comes with the money, and they, so at least we know the money exists. But, and of course, Roth tells Michael, you know, I need the money. I need it. I'm feeling ill. I'm going to take a nap. But when I get up, the money will be here. Or it won't. So, in the meantime, Fredo gets to take out the people to see the sights, to show them a good time, because that's what Fredo does well. Fredo, by the way, and we find out a little bit more later when he actually has a little monologue about it, Fredo is not happy with his lot in life. Like, Fredo, who's like good time Charlie, he's not satisfied with that. That's how he's being used. Abused by his younger brother, for God's sake. The gall.
Can you think of anything worse?
Ugh, I can't. I just, there's no way.
I don't know. We have a pretty good younger brother.
But he's waiting.
Playing the long game.
All debts are paid, right? Settle all the accounts. He said so last time. Man. And me with my check engine light. So,
I don't, is Drew aware of that?
Is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's great. Nothing can be finer. So, so we have this conflict between, because Michael's like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't make this deal with this dictator. And, of course, Fredo takes out the senator and some of the important officials and the hangers-on to a live sex show with Superman. And we find out not too subtly that even though he said he'd never, he told Michael that he doesn't even recognize Johnny Ola, never even heard of a Johnny Ola. He tells everybody that's how he found the sex show, because Johnny Ola had been there before and suggested it. So, dun dun.
Oops.
So Michael now knows who the traitor is. And when he realizes that, he dispatches his bodyguard to go kill Roth. Or maybe that was his plan all along, actually. I mean, it has nothing to do with
Fredo. Yeah, that was already his plan.
Yeah.
It's to kill Roth and Johnny Ola.
Yes. So Johnny Ola bites it. He is strangled. But Roth doesn't end up dying. And instead, he's taken to a hospital. And the enforcer sent to finish the job is shot trying to kill him. And this is all at the New Year's Eve party time, where at the stroke of midnight, everybody's kissing one another. And Michael grabs Fredo and kisses him and says that he knows that it was, I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.
The Sicilian kiss of death.
Yes. Are there oranges in the scene?
There are a lot of oranges around.
Yeah.
All throughout this movie.
Yes, yes, there are. But yeah, so the gorillas actually attack. This is a real thing. On New Year's Eve, I guess, the gorillas took over and Batista resigned. And everybody has to get out in a hurry, all the foreigners. So Michael is telling Fredo to get on a plane with him. And Fredo's like, oh, no, no, no.
Yeah, that was actually like a great speech by Batista. He was like, you know what? I'm out of here. I quit. Good luck. Fuck all of you.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, so then we flash back to 1917. And Don Fanucci is aware of the partnership between Vito Clemenza and their buddy Sal Tessio, played by John Aprea. And he decides he wants his share of the profits every week. You know, just enough to get his beak wet.
He keeps saying that. It's so annoying.
Yeah, yeah, it is. So, Clemenza and Tessio agree to paying, because what are you going to do, right? Can't fight City Hall. But Vito's like, yeah, let me handle it.
Yeah, and you get the sense that in this dynamic up to this point, like, Vito has just kind of been the quiet, dumb muscle.
Yeah, because it was Clemenza who was more of the leader of the bunch.
Yeah, and Tessio was an experienced criminal. And Vito is just the one who had the apartment with the spaghetti.
Yeah, exactly. And so he meets with Fanucci.
Oh, and in every flashback, there's another Corleone kid.
Yes, and did you notice, to bring up the Olympics, thank you for bringing it up, that, of course, Fredo was a sickly child, and they do cupping on him.
Yes.
Did you see Michael Phelps's back?
Oh, yes.
During the Olympics? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not just his back.
Well, it doesn't work, just so you know. It's voodoo.
He looked like he was attacked by that Star Trek monster.
So, do you know where I first saw... Here, I'll do a Jimmy Pardo thing. True or false? I first saw cupping in a Roman Polanski film, The Fearless Vampire Hunters.
I'm going to say true.
No, it's false. The first time I saw cupping was in a porn movie that I found left in the VCR when I was... No, of course it's true. Yeah, see, Jimmy Pardo can do this whole thing shtick much better. He's more like the Charlotte in the farm.
Not the Templeton.
Not the... Hey, Templeton was awesome. I mean, you know, he's Paul Lynn, but still.
What, are you saying Paul Lynn's not awesome?
No, he is awesome. Totally awesome. So Vito is like, hey, here, instead of $600 that he wants, give me $50 each, and I'll make a deal with him. They're like, okay, I guess. Do your best. So he goes, and he gets Fanucci to take only $100 instead of the $600. So even if this was all that happened, he still got out without paying himself. And his buddies got off paying much less than they anticipated. So everybody's happy.
Yeah, that's actually what I expected.
Except he was going to have to pay him everything later.
Oh, was that the deal?
Yeah, he said, here's $100 and give me more time.
Ah. So, but Fanucci likes the young kid spirit. So, mm-hmm. We have a neighborhood festa going on. And Vito, in a nice little, like, I don't know, Daniel Craig as James Bond kind of way. I was thinking of Spectre, the Mexico scene. Or not, I don't know. Anyway, so Vito ends up killing the Don. Murdering him. Straight up.
In the Spectre scene, he was crawling over a roof that was collapsing, though, right?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, you have to... Yeah, it's not an equal thing, you know. You're
also, there was a helicopter.
Yeah, yeah. This was much more subtle than that.
Yeah, and he sets a towel on fire.
Well, yeah, but and you get a nice nice panoramic view of, like, the... maybe panoramic's not the right word, but you get a nice overhead view of the whole celebration in the street, and then the very narrow view of inside the hallway. And yeah, he set the towel on fire.
After the trick with the light bulb, which is also Bond-ish.
Yes.
That's more like Mission Impossible, right?
Yeah.
And also, also much like Bond, the psychopath, or at least sociopath, he goes right from killing Finucci to telling his children that he loves them very, very much. He's a good dad. Anything you say about Vito, he's a good dad. So then we go to 1959 Nevada and Lake Tahoe, the compound, after Michael flees Cuba. And Tom Hagen tells him that Roth escaped Cuba after having a stroke and is recovering in Miami. And that Michael's bodyguard is dead and Fredo is probably hiding in New York. He also tells Michael that Kay had a miscarriage while he was away. And Michael is distraught and is really concerned about the sex of the child. He wants a masculine child.
Yeah, poor Tom. So poor Tom, seven son, always knew what's going on. Anything that you can have it on. Anything that you can have it on. He's like the brother Jay of the family. He always has to give the bad news.
Also, he doesn't get to have, I don't know, this is not necessarily Brother Jay, but he doesn't get to have nearly the fun. The original script had Tom having an affair with somebody else's wife. I can't, with maybe, with, is it with Sonny's ex, or Sonny's widow, or I don't know, somebody like that.
It's alluded to later, but it never says who it is.
Exactly, because
they... Because Michael says his mistress.
Exactly, they cut out that whole scene about the mistress and just mention it at the end for no reason. So, yeah, Tom got trimmed a little bit.
Just because Michael was being a dick.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah, that's what I just figured. But turns out there's a whole subplot going on. But, yeah, so Michael is super distraught. And Tom doesn't know the sex of the child, and so or claims not to know. And so it's all very complicated and frustrating. Because Michael's plans are not going as he planned them. Things are going awry. The check engine light of his little criminal enterprise has come on.
Yeah, so his big plan of reckoning really went to shit in Cuba.
Exactly.
I think that was supposed to be his baptism moment where he settled all family business. It didn't happen.
Yeah, not at all. So then we flash back to 1920, and with Finucci dead, Vito earns the respect of the neighborhood and starts to like intercede in local disputes, and he operates out of the storefront of the Ginkgo Pura Olive Oil Company.
I think it's Genco.
Genco, I'm sorry. Genco, yeah. Did I say Ginkgo, like biloba?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. The Genco.
Ironic.
Yes. Is it ironic? I don't know.
That your memory would change it.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, so Vito now plays the sort of the arbiter, the mediator, the power broker in the neighborhood. He settles disputes. And there's that fun scene where the woman's getting evicted. And so he intercedes on her behalf to the landlord, who at first is not impressed.
Dismissive.
Yes, very dismissive.
Disrespectfully.
Yes.
But he has that little speech where he says, go talk to the neighborhood. They know what a good man I am. They know.
Yes, and he comes back.
You should ask around.
Yeah. Hey, turns out this lady's not evicted and she gets a hell of a deal on rent. Due to Don Vito.
And the landlord desperately tries to flee the office.
Well, and I don't know if you read the fact that, I guess, the office itself, there was some sort of, like, in the lock itself, it had, like, a little nail that if you moved the nail, you couldn't open the door. And so a whole scene with the landlord guy having trouble opening the door to get in and opening the door to come out, and Clemenza has to open it, was all real, and they didn't tell him.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So his
that was Genco. Yeah. That wasn't Clemenza.
Oh, was it Genco? Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
That's great.
Yeah. It's just a fun little detail. So that was having fun. So we flash to, of course, when everybody's having fun, and then we flash to the unfun, where we go to Washington, D.C., 1959, and a Senate committee where Senator Geary is a member of the committee, and they're investigating the Corleone family. and they're questioning Willie Chi-Chi, who is a soldier in the crime family, and they have the whole mafia thing where they have like the hierarchy behind them, the organization chart, and so that's kind of fun. But since Willie Chi-Chi never got any, he's the button man, but he never got any orders directly from Michael.
Because of all the buffas.
So it's all Senator Geary, which is hilarious. He excuses himself after trying to play both sides also.
Exposition.
That was during Michael's testimony.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah, we go back and forth during the testimony. By the way, do you know who the senators were? Some of the senators? On the Senate committee were, among others, Roger Corman and Richard Matheson of I Am Legend fame.
Really?
Yeah, and a ton of Twilight Zone episodes he wrote. He's a prolific screenwriter and author. And, of course, Roger Corman of the Roger Corman directed movies.
I Am Legend is a great book and a shitty movie.
Yep. Well, someday we'll do The Last Man on Earth.
I didn't think the movie was that bad.
It's not the book. It's World War Z. I think we had this whole conversation.
Yes.
Not that I'm dismissing you. I'm just saying, you know, you guys don't see which side you're on for me. So
No, you're actually dismissing me with your hand. That's fine. Bafangul.
Yeah. Bafangul yourself. During questioning, Michael denies all the criminal allegations from everything, from the Salazzo thing, from Captain McCluskey, to the Nevada casino things. He makes a big statement about how he's just a good businessman.
He's actually giggling about how easy this is.
Exactly, pretty much. And he basically defies the committee to find a witness to testify against him. And so the committee's like, okay, harumph. We'll do that.
He's asked point blank about the police captain and Salazzo murders. And he's just like, no, don't know anything about that.
So the chairman promises that he has a witness that'll testify to actually putting him like in the criminal activity. And that's when we find out that this witness is Frank Pentangeli, who he made a deal with the FBI and is going to testify against Michael. And Tom Hagen and Michael discuss the problem, and that now they know that Roth's strategy is to destroy Michael. And in the meantime, Fredo is found, and he's persuaded to return to Nevada. And we have that touching scene where Fredo explains why he feels aggrieved, you know, why he felt betrayed by the family. He was passed over by his younger brother. The humiliation. The shame. And he just wanted respect. They were offering him respect. Didn't go out so well. So, and he also claims he didn't know that they were going to kill him.
Yeah, because that makes disloyalty better.
Yeah.
They weren't going to kill you.
Exactly. So, anyway, Michael ends up telling Fredo that you're nothing to me now. Not a brother, not a friend, nothing. But immediately tells Al Neary, played by Richard Bright, that nothing is going to happen to Fredo while their mother is alive. You know, because you can't do that. So, then we go to the hearing where Frank Pentangeli is to testify. And he arrives and everything's fine. He's going to get ready to testify. And he sees Michael shows up in the gallery with Tom Hagen and a mysterious guy who turns out is Pentangeli's brother, who they took in from Sicily. And I don't know if this is an implied threat that they are going to kill his whole family or something, but, or that they like put the values of the Sicilians imposed upon him. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought it was just a reminder of his oaths of loyalty to the family.
I also took it as a that there was peace between Michael and him, and so there should be peace between the families.
Well, whatever the case, it causes Frank to totally recant his previous statements. And he says he just told the FBI what they wanted to hear. Oh, so sorry, you know. So the committee has to adjourn. And, of course, Hagen is demanding an apology, which is great. You always want that.
Although he's pretty much drowned out.
Yes. Oh, it's all a big hubbub. It's a kerfuffle.
A Templeton, if you will.
All right. Okay. Make one reference to a cartoon. So, later at a hotel room, Kay tries to leave Michael and take the children with her. And Michael at first tries to kind of cajole her to stay, that he'll be a better husband, blah, blah, blah. But events ends up losing his temper. And he ends up hitting her after she says that she didn't have... You're shaking your head.
Yeah, I know. Because it was ridiculous.
It was ridiculous. It was great. It was one of those powerful pieces of cinema. And actually, Talia Shire came up with it.
Came up with the abortion thing?
That was her idea.
Well, that's dark.
Yeah, in exchange, she got more lines in the movie. As a direct result. Like, that was her thank you for... Yeah, a very dark turn. Because when Kay says, you know, it wasn't, we're leaving you, I'm leaving you, you're not a good father, you're a danger to my family, and oh yeah, that wasn't a miscarriage, it was an abortion. It was a male child, and I killed it because I didn't want it to be born to this family. So, that's as dark as things get in the world, I think. That's like Shakespearean type tragedy.
And he's so short that when he hit her, he kind of had to jump up to do it.
A little bit, yeah.
Karateka style?
Yeah.
Now, the question is, did she really have an abortion, or did she say she was just calling it that's what it was?
Does it matter?
Not.
I mean, as long as he thinks it was an abortion, and that it was a male child. But yeah.
Well, because one is, you know, actively against the Catholic Church.
Well, there's no telling whether she's a Catholic or not. I mean, it wouldn't.
No, but he is.
Well, but he also has people killed, which is also on that list of things you're not supposed to do. Yeah, I don't know if there's a church element to it. We'll get to church elements later at a different time. But. I think this was actually pretty great, although it was, you know, obviously a difficult scene to watch.
Yeah. The heartbreaking part is when they cut to the hallway outside when they're with screaming the each other, and the kids are just like kind of hanging out and playing in the hallway.
Yeah. Yep. Yep, yep, yep. And so then, of course, after the big old screaming match and the kids, we flash back to 1925. Turns out this is a movie of, you know, parallels the past and the present. And turns out the past is getting progressively happier. And Vito is getting progressively, like, in more control. And in the present, things are getting a lot less happy. And Michael is losing his shit.
He's unraveling.
Yes. So, back to 1925. Vito is having a vacation in Sicily with the family. And... he is introduced to the elderly 90-year-old Don Ciccio.
This was so predictable.
Of course. Well, what do you expect?
I expected this.
Yeah. Well, you give the people what they want, right? Isn't that a saying?
Yeah. This is great.
Yep. So, yeah. So he kills the 90-year-old Don Ciccio. Blind and deaf, or nearly blind, nearly deaf. Doesn't matter. He's going down.
And Tomasino gets injured.
Yes.
During their getaway.
Yep. That's why he has a limp. Yep. And then we go to April 1959. And Carmela Corleone dies. Which spells bad news for Fredo.
Well, it spells bad news for the family in general.
Yeah, that's true. So the whole Corleone family is...
But Connie comes home.
Yeah, everybody reunites for the funeral, of course. And so Connie comes home, and she tries to be the peacemaker between Fredo and Michael. And Michael eventually ends up hugging Fredo, at the same time telling one of his button men to take him out. So,
yeah.
So Michael, Tom, and Rocco Lampone discuss their final dealings with Hyman Roth, who has been trying to seek asylum in different countries, but nobody wants him, including Israel. So, and Tegan is like, no, you're the Corleone family is dead. We're fine. We don't need to take out Roth. And Michael's like, oh no, we're taking him out. That quote about, you know, one thing we learned is that anybody can be killed. Anybody. Let's see. So yeah, and then Tom visits Pentangeli at the military base, and they have a fun little conversation.
Yeah, Frankie Five Angels is a history buff.
He is a history buff.
You were always interested in politics, history. I remember you talking about Hitler back in 1933.
I still read a lot. I got good stuff in there.
You were around the old-timers who dreamed of how the family should be organized, how they based them on the old Roman legions and called them regimes, the capos and the soldiers. And it worked.
Yeah, it worked. Those were the great old days, you know? And we was like the Roman Empire. The Corleone family was like the Roman Empire.
It was once. Thank you. Plot against the Emperor failed. Plotters were always given a chance to let the families keep their fortunes.
Yeah, but only the rich guys, Tom. The little guys, they got knocked off, and all their estates went to the emperors. Unless they went home and they killed themselves, then nothing happened. And the families... Their families were taken care of, Tom.
That was a good break. Nice deal.
Yeah. They went home and sat in a hot bath, opened up their veins, and bled to death. And sometimes they had a little party before they did it.
Don't worry about anything, Frankie Five Angels.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah, so they take care of Frankie, or Frankie takes care of himself. And
why?
Why does he do it? He does it because that way his family won't be hunted down.
More than that, his family will be taken care of.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so it was a good deal. You know, he tried, he failed, and, you know, now he can provide for his family. So, in the meantime, Connie has arranged for Kay to visit with the children, but can't be around when Michael's home, so she's got to get out of there, but she stays too long. And we get another great scene where Michael slams the door on Kay.
Paralleling the end of the first movie.
Yes. And then we have the montage of assassinations that Jason has been expecting. Where Hyman Roth is killed by Rocco Lampone, Jack Ruby style, and they find Frankie Five Angels dead at the military base. And then Al takes Fredo fishing.
For the last time.
Yes, as he's saying his Hail Mary to help catch the fish. And then we have, again, what I think is a pretty great little flashback to 1941 where they're planning a surprise birthday party for Vito. And so we have Sonny, James Caan, and is introducing Carlo Rizzi, who's Connie's future husband, and the one who eventually betrayed Sonny, to the family. And they're talking about the recent attack on Pearl Harbor and how rude it was for the Japs to attack the, Pearl Harbor on their father's birthday. Because Vito was born on December 7th.
That does sound pretty rude.
Yes.
And that's where we discover, yeah, that Michael's enlisted.
Yeah. And Sonny doesn't think that's good at all. Sonny's like, you know, what does college teach you how to be dumb? You come back dumber? And then we get to see Tessio, who returns from the grave, Obi-Wan Kenobi style.
It was so great to see
him. It was. Yeah, that's
with the cake.
Yeah. Yeah. You just love that. That's the thing. And I actually did some, I found some YouTube episodes of Fish. Fish does not really hold up.
No, but, you don't say.
And Barney Miller may not hold up as much as I remember liking it as a kid.
It doesn't.
But Fish is great. Abe Vigoda just has a charm to him. And he does a lot of, like, you know, deadpanning Mr. Roper style stuff in Barney Miller. But it's always fun to see Abe Vigoda. And yeah, so Michael is, you know, this whole flashback is pretty much Michael reminiscing. Is that what you got from it too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, Michael is just sitting by himself in Tahoe. All alone and pretty much not broken necessarily, but friendless, familyless. I mean, he's got his crime family, but his regular family is gone.
Yeah, it's pretty sad and haunting. I mean, that final scene of him, which it turns out is looks like the home screen on the Blu-ray. Of him just, like, standing out, looking over the lake while his brother is being murdered. Yeah, it's both beautiful and haunting all at the same time. But yeah, where in the first movie, you know, he's settling all family accounts and then settling all business. And then, you know, everybody's together and moving to Nevada with, you know, hopes and dreams in their eyes this time around. Everything gets settled, but he has nothing. Everything that he's worked for, he has nothing.
In the original rough cut of the movie, it ran almost 6 hours long.
And, oh, my God.
And Vito's storyline went all the way into the Prohibition era, where he had a gang war with Al Capone, and it talks about Luca Brasi's exploits as the Hatchet Man. And Michael's story continued where he gained political influence in the 60s and it was due to his connections with Senator Geary. And this is where we imply the role in the assassination, the Kennedy assassination. And except for some of the deleted scenes that they used in The Godfather novel for television in 1977 and a couple of stills of Robert De Niro as a middle-aged Vito, they just cut it to what they had. By the way, Coppola wanted Brando to come back and play young Vito because he was convinced that Brando could play any age.
Oh, God.
Now, this is method acting taken too far.
Well, they aged him up for the first movie, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess theoretically, if he lost a bunch of weight, maybe. I don't know. It would be tough in 1974 to pull that off. Turns out he couldn't have been bothered to shoot that last scene anyway, so. So, Brother Jay, your verdict. The Godfather Part 2.
It was okay. I mean, first of all, it's a gorgeous movie. It's beautifully shot. It's really well acted. But I think I said that I found the story to be really formulaic and kind of just the same movie, pretty much as the first.
Brother Drew, was it worth it?
I love this movie. I think it's better than the first one, which was a transcendent movie to begin with. I think this is everything you want out of a sequel. It enriches the first story. It continues it. carries on some of the themes, but also presents new ones that are still related. And it goes from being like a almost a triumphant family drama to being like this really sad, tragic morality tale. And just creates a whole other arc to the story while continuing in the first one. At the same time, it fills in the origin story of, you know, the most iconic character from the first movie in a way that made it seem completely fresh and really its own character, you know, with such a tremendous performance by De Niro. Yeah, and like we said before, this movie is beautiful. I mean, I watched it on a transferred digital copy from a DVD, so I haven't even seen the Blu-ray version, which I bet is amazing. But all the performances are great. I mean, Fredo is heartbreaking throughout the whole movie. He does such a great job. His death is really troubling, even though you know it's coming. And Michael, who I thought had such tremendous charisma in the first movie, you're rooting for him so much in the first movie. And you are so happy when he triumphs at the end. To just watch him disintegrate in this movie and to not be rooting for him at all anymore, and to sort of feel like, you know, it's his just desserts when he's sitting there all alone at the end, I think is really high praise for what this movie accomplishes. I mean, I think it's amazing. It is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah. Well, it won Best Picture over, by the way. One of the competing films was The Conversation, which was also a Coppola-produced movie. So he had a good year that year. He also beat The Towering Inferno, which does not hold up, and Chinatown, which I think is a better picture. But it's probably best that Polanski didn't win the Oscar because he's a child rapist. Robert De Niro did win Best Supporting Actor for this movie. So Brando won Best Actor and De Niro won Best Supporting Actor for playing the same character, which is kind of fun.
And did De Niro have more screen time than Brando?
De Niro probably did. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, Pacino lost his Best Actor. So yeah, that guy can't get a break. Poor Al.
Yeah.
Who did he lose Best Actor to?
Oh, what else was that year? It was pretty good year. Was it Jack Nicholson? Could have been for Chinatown. Who was it? Oh, Art Carney won Best Actor for Harry and Tonto. Ellen Bernstein won Best Actress for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Francis Ford Coppola won Best Director. Ingrid Bergman won Best Supporting Actress for Murder on the Orient Express. Chinatown won Best Original Screenplay. Godfather 2 won Best Adapted Screenplay. Godfather 2, I think, picked up way more awards than any. That was the highlight. Yeah, The Godfather picked up 6. And both Chinatown and The Godfather were nominated for 11. So, yeah, no, Best Picture was Godfather, Chinatown, The Conversation, Lenny, and The Towering Inferno. Best Actor, Art Carney for Harry and Tonto. Albert Finney, Murder on the Orient Express. Dustin Hoffman in Lenny, the Lenny Bruce story. Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, and then Al Pacino. Talia Shire was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Best Supporting Actor, Robert De Niro won, but he was up against Jeff Bridges in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, and Michael Gazzo, Frankie Five Angels, and Lee Strasberg as Hyman Roth. So again, three Godfather actors were all up for Best Supporting Actor. Just crazy. So, let's see.
Nope.
So we have here The Godfather Part 2, featuring as Fredo Corleone, John Cazale. Who's in The Deer Hunter with John Savage. Who was in 1981's The Amateur with Robert Beatty. who was Dr. Ralph Halvorsen in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Banana. Banana.
When's the last time you've watched the Deer Hunter?
I have never seen The Deer Hunter because the first part is so slow that I can't get into it. As much as I love Christopher Walken, it's just the first part is so slow. And I understand it has a rather exciting ending.
It's a really troubling movie.
So, housekeeping?
Sounds like you have some.
Well, no, not really. I mean, yes, really, but I don't have any resolution to it. Less than a month after I bought a car from our father, it started rough idling and the check engine light went on. And I started looking for, oh shit, things that could have been done to it. And I actually scheduled this actually happened when Mom was in the car. She's like, oh, maybe you should call Dad. I'm like, why would I call Dad? It would just depress him. turns out when I mentioned this to Dad, because I'm like, hey, have you changed the spark plugs recently? Like maybe he had never changed the spark plugs. Who was I kidding? He's like, yeah, why? Like, well, this is happening. He goes, oh, this is suspiciously like something that happened before. And I'm like, oh, and he goes, yeah. Do you have access to that? You know, get that folder.
There, the big folder I gave
yeah,
you.
Yeah, there's a receipt that he said it was kind of a large thing that happened. So you might have got to get that into them right away. He was thinking it happened pretty recently. Maybe there was some like warranty thing. I don't know if you have your phone with you, Drew. I just sent you the receipt.
I cannot, so I'll have to look at it later.
Okay, well, shall I tell you how much it cost Dad to fix the same problem before? Or similar symptoms, how about that?
Yes.
You want to take a guess at it?
$842.
Okay, Jason said $1,000. And you have both underbid. It is $1,308 in 2012.
Price is Right style, I would have won.
Yes, Jason would have won. Price is Right style. Turns out I am the loser. So we'll find out. Hopefully it won't be that bad. They had to change a couple other things, or they did a couple other things maybe at the same time that weren't really related to the problem. But I will know more next Monday when it goes to the shop. Because they couldn't get me in any sooner. So I am trying to drive this thing as little as possible because I don't want it to get worse. But one car, and this is the week of appointments. I have so many appointments this week. And this is my long week to work, so... And I got a letter from my homeowner association, again, complaining about my lawn not being mowed enough. It's fucking 2 inches of water standing in my backyard. Well, actually, that's an exaggeration. It's like a half an inch of water. It's been torrential rains. So.
It has rained for like 63 straight days.
Oh, I am. Yeah. So and they were threatening to charge me $150 for my second violation, which I'm like, fuck you. I didn't even know that your check engine light could flash. Anyway.
Well, different patterns and different blinks mean different things.
As it turns out.
Yeah.
It was running so well. I was even thinking, man, I bet you my engine wasn't really doing great in the Explorer because this just purrs like a kitten.
Blink 4 times for $1,300.
Exactly, yeah.
Did you buy a camera?
Oh, no, but you know what? I put a stereo in it. I don't know.
Oh, man.
That could have been the yeah. No matter what happens, it'll be a fun little tale to tell.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts Dial it already.